Hello, and welcome to Spectology, the Science Fiction Book Club podcast. I'm your host, Adrian.
I'm Matt.
I'm Julia.
Hey, everybody.
Hi, Julia. So
Spectology is a book club podcast where each month we read a science fiction book and talk about it over the course of two episodes. We are this month reading The Tea Master and the Detective by Elliot de Bodard, which was chosen by our guest, Julia Rios. Julia is a Hugo Award-winning editor, is a friend, is a really cool person. I've been on a panel with her about sci-fi movies up in Boston one time, which folks might have
heard. She also has her own podcast, which is great, called... This is why we're like this,
which Matt's
I
been
have
on.
Been a guest on.
Yep.
Which was really fun. Highly recommend.
So, Julia, do you want to introduce yourself, all the things that we've missed?
Yeah, sure. So I think the thing I'm most doing right now is This Is Why We're Like This, which is a podcast about the movies that made a lasting impression on us as childhoods and sort of re-examining them with our adult eyes and being like, oh, this is why we're like this. I see. So Matt chose Bedknobs and Broomsticks for his episode. It was great. We had a good time. This led to us discovering that The Incredible Mr. Limpet is an entirely different movie, and it's also completely whack.
That movie is so whack. It also led to me becoming obsessed with Angela Lansbury to a whole new degree. I have been watching Murder, She Wrote on Amazon Prime. Recommend.
Yeah. Matt will tell me about Murder, She Wrote episodes when we like post-recording. So...
Murder, She Wrote is amazing. It's just every episode goes to some new ridiculous high concept.
It's so good. So far, my favorite was the one where she becomes a member of the House of Representatives.
What?
Yeah, but only for one episode.
What
a wild show. I've never seen an episode. That is wild. I might need to do that.
It really
my
is.
Mom
it
loved really them is. When I was a kid and would watch it religiously. So
it's also very much like the past is a different country vibes. Because you
talk
know,
about big mood right
all,
now.
Yeah, it's all shot in LA, basically, almost all of it. And you know, I mean, I grew up in LA, so for me, seeing this like LA of the mid 80s is like absolutely wild.
Oh, cool. Julia, is there anything else you're working on or want to plug or talk about right now?
Really, like right now, I don't know. I feel like This Is Why We're Like This is the thing I'm focused the most on, because it's something that offers me a source of joy and hope in this time.
For real.
So I have done editing for multiple places. I'm mostly on an editing break just at the moment, although the last big project I worked on is out now through Serial Box, and it's called Machina. It's the authors are Fran Wild and Curtis Chen and Malka Older and Martha Wells, and it's a lot of fun. It's basically cool. Two rival companies in an AI terraforming Mars tech race. And there's all kinds of like interpersonal office drama that goes on during this, and lots of like startling reveals about both the interoffice drama and the AI.
Very
so if
fun.
That sounds
oh my
like
God,
something
that sounds
fun,
good.
Yeah, you should totally go listen. It's really great.
That's awesome. I do hope people go listen to both the Serial Box as well as your podcast, because it's like a lot of fun, especially right now where like nostalgia is actually like a useful boon instead of like a, you know, problematic instinct.
Yeah, well, and I want to say like this is why we're like this is very much about like looking at it critically. We do actually pick apart what kinds of messages things are sending. And it's a comedy podcast, so we do it with a lot of fun involved. But like we're really looking at like, OK, what did we see as children and what did we internalize from this? What was it trying right. to teach us and what did it actually teach us? Which I think is useful. I think it's both nostalgia and sort of aware of the dangers of nostalgia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I realize there's one more thing that I should share if it's okay. So I'm Mexican American. My father was from Mexico and he immigrated to the US when he was young. And so I'm half Mexican. I still have family over there. Because of that, I was on a big group to Worldcon in San Jose in 2018 called the Mexicanx Initiative. And the idea was just to get a bunch of Mexican and Mexican American creators to go to Worldcon. And out of that came two different anthologies, which are both available for free to download as an ebook. So I do want to point people in that direction. If you don't know anything, because I mostly didn't know anything about Mexican science fiction at the time that I was involved in that. Now I've had the chance to read so many wonderful stories by other Mexican authors. Those anthologies are called A Larger Reality and A Larger Reality 2.0. And I'm pretty sure you can find them by looking A Larger Reality up online. Mm-hmm. I think there is a larger reality.mx or something like that website where you can find them.
Yep. I've definitely retweeted tweets about these things on the Spectology Twitter feed before as well. They're very cool and totally worth picking up.
They're cool. And they're just so many different authors. I do have stories in both of them. My story in the first one is nice and uplifting. My story in the second one is very short, but is literally about a horrible virus. So maybe don't.
Reader be warned.
Good
cool. Morning. So we'll throw links down to all this stuff in the show notes as we always do, so folks can check it out there as well. So with that, we should talk a little bit about The Tea Master and the Detective by Elliot de Baudard. It is a book. I've read a little bit of it so far. Matt has previously read it, and Julia, even though she picked it, has not read it so far. So we're kind of coming at it, you know, the pre-read we always do sort of spoiler free. So we talk kind of about the book facts, but not the plot of the book itself.
Book facts.
Indeed. Book facts. And then in the post-read, which we'll post towards the end of the month, we will talk about the book in depth. We'll get into the characters and plot and a lot about the themes. We tend to, you know, in a similar way to Julia's podcast, really pick apart, what does this book mean as much as anything else? But for right now, this is a novella, so it's a pretty short book, published in, I believe, 2018. Is that right? Or was it 2019?
It was published in 2018, and it actually won the Nebula Award. It's the 2018 yes. Nebula Award that is awarded the next year in 2019.
Right. So. Okay. So that's what I'm thinking.
So, yeah.
It was also a finalist for the Hugo Award for Best Novella, I know. And I mm-hmm. think the World Fantasy Award. Yeah, it looks like that as well in 2019. It was very popular when it came out. I think it's part of a larger universe of novellas, although it definitely stands alone. It is not the third in a trilogy that you have to have read the others for. It is rather a larger universe that de Baudard writes within, which is all about spaceships with minds and personalities and feelings. And it's very nice. They make tea for humans. no spoilers, but that is a plot piece.
It's in the title.
It is. It is exactly. Okay. So it is, I think it's around 100, 150 pages. It's relatively short. It's you'll read it in an hour or two. We tried this month to pick a relatively short book because I know Matt and I have just zero energy to read anything long or hard to read in any way right now. It's also a really, I called it before recording, domestic cozy. It's definitely it has themes that are really hard and difficult, but it's also a really nice and warm book. It feels kind of sitting down for tea with a friend in a really nice way. And so also we picked it from that perspective of wanting something that maybe isn't as relevant as last month's book, which was # way too real.
Still a good book though.
Great book, but
but you know, maybe at some point in your life, check it out.
Should we talk about the author a little bit as well?
Sure. So
this is the first thing I've read by her. So I'm curious how you guys know of her, or like, you know, not just how you know of her, but like what you've read and what you think of her.
Yeah. So I've actually read several of her works before. I really enjoy her writing. I actually did get to edit one of them. I believe it was a reprint. That was back when I was working for Uncanny Magazine. So you can probably find that one for free online. She's really interesting. She's French-Vietnamese, and she does a lot of really cool world building with different cultures. So I really enjoy that aspect of her work. And I have not read this one, but I have heard from multiple sources that it's really just sort of soothing and a cozy piece, which is what I was really looking forward to and one of the reasons why I suggested it this time.
I agree. Having read it, that is how I feel about it.
Right. I think she's written, am I right about this? She wrote a like fantasy trilogy that was Aztec themed.
Yeah, that was, I think, her very first fantasy trilogy. And then she had another series that started with The House of the Shattered Wings, possibly. It might have been.
That sounds familiar.
I might be getting the title wrong because there are a few books in there and they're houses.
That is the first one. I just looked it up.
That one is set in sort of an alternate 1920s Paris, like kind of a secondary fantasy world version of a 1920s Paris. And it's very cool.
I'm so into all of these things.
And I say like it's set there, but it's also got all of the different cultural tie-ins. So that has a lot of heavily Vietnamese cultural tie-ins that, you know, is actually her own heritage that she's exploring.
Mm. And this novel or novella too, Tea Master and the Detective, also has a lot of like Vietnamese influence in the world building and the culture and all that stuff as well, which is a lot of fun to read. I don't know if I've ever read Vietnamese science fiction or Vietnamese cultural science fiction before. I've read like Thai science fiction and stuff. So this has been actually really enjoying that because it's not a culture I like know a whole lot about at all.
And I think that that's true for a lot of people. And I think that's actually also something that in some ways is true for Aliette. Like there's something, I've had this conversation with so many different people who are either mixed race or they're immigrants. And there's this sort of burden of trying to figure out where you came from and how you connect to it that is simultaneously good and also comes with a lot of like anger and grief because you don't have it automatically and people assume that you should or you do. Like, for instance, the fact that my father didn't teach me Spanish when I was growing up because he didn't want me to be mistaken for a Mexican, which, as you know, I mean, we were Mexican and I learned Spanish in school. When I was 12, he wanted me to speak it perfectly without having ever learned it as a child. So he was simultaneously this push and pull. He was a very complicated person where he wanted me to learn it and he wanted me to know my heritage, but he also wanted me to not be obviously Mexican because that would be bad.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting push and pull for an immigrant in particular. I can imagine that's the sort of like both wanting your heritage and also not wanting the like kind of like baggage that comes with it in a new place that everyone else knowing that's your heritage.
Yeah, and just like for Aliette, the House of the Shattered Wings is really interesting to me because she's doing it in Paris, which is where I think she actually lives in Paris now. I know she lives in France, but I think she lives in Paris. So that's actually her home city now. But it's also got these Vietnamese cultural things. So it's sort of exploring the various aspects of her identity in a very alternate world fantasy setting. And I thought that was very, very cool.
Yeah, I'm really interested to ask you a little more about this kind of cross-cultural author experience, cross-cultural creator experience. Do you are you into that? Like,
I mean, sure, go ahead.
Yeah, I feel like this is a really interesting topic that we haven't talked about a lot on this podcast, and it's certainly relevant to this book, you know. So what do you think are some of the, you know, What do you think are some of the things that go through the mind of a creator that, I mean, I ask you this specifically because I know that you have written, you haven't, you know, you've been this creator also, you know, so from your own experience, maybe like, what are some of the things that go through your mind when you're trying to approach doing like science fiction or speculative fiction from this perspective, you know, say you're doing world building, for example, how do you think about bringing that experience into that?
I mean, so this is a really hard question, and I think it's different for everyone, and it also depends on when you catch them. I once interviewed Stephen Graham Jones, who is a horror author, and he is a member of the Blackfeet Nation. And I asked him how consciously he incorporates Blackfeet into his work. And he said, well, I am Blackfeet, so then anything I write is Blackfeet. And it doesn't matter if I say it is or whatever, because I've written it, it is. And I thought that was such a good answer. But at the same time, from my personal writing, like when I was writing for A Larger Reality, the first Mexicanics Initiative anthology, I knew I wanted to write something that had a character, a main character who was something close to me, not entirely me. My main character had grown up with the sort of Mexican-American upbringing where she also had other Mexican-American family friends that were nearby. So she also probably spoke Spanish and had more of a cultural community around her than I did. But I wanted to give that experience of being fully like assimilated in American culture. You grew up here, you're fluent in English, you never didn't speak English, but also like you have this part of your identity that's still part of your identity and it's who you are. And that sort of incorporating that is really interesting. That story, the first story, is it's called A Truth Universally Acknowledged, which is a reference to the first line of the novel Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen. And it's a sort of like multiple realities, time slip sort of story where the character is slipping through different realities, trying to fix a mistake that she's made in one of them. And, when she like works out that one of the realities is very different, like the first line of her favorite novel has completely changed. And
oh, I love it.
So that's where that's going with the title. But in all of those realities, lots of people present differently, but they are still the same people at heart. And I think for me, the cultural thing there was sort of like, I wanted to show she has one best friend, Osmundo, and he's different, slightly different in every reality, but she always finds him and he always is her best friend. And even though he's different, he's still Osmundo. And that to me was sort of like, I wanted to be clear that Mexican and Mexican American people are still people and that there are a variety of types of people, because I think people get stereotyped so easily. And so I was really conscious of wanting to not have one stereotype that people fell into, and showing how people could be people across different realities while still being complicated. Mm. I don't know if that answered your question.
Totally. Yeah. No, I mean, it's just really, it's awesome to hear you talk about, I mean, it did, but it's also just awesome to hear you talk about this in general, because you're somebody like, you know, is like very thoughtful about these topics. It's both part of your experience, and also you've clearly thought a lot about it. So it's really cool to just hear what you have to say about it.
Yeah. I really like that kind of metaphor of like different, like these different cultural aspects as entirely different realities. And it's like, you're still the same person at heart, but also I'm from like a really rural place in Alaska, right? And I kind of like come from almost like a like more redneck culture, especially compared to like New York City where I live now. And there is that feeling of like going back and being like, oh yeah, I kind of like slip into like a different mode of being, and I like act somewhat different on the outside, I think, while also still, you know, it's like the way I present myself in that context as opposed to like, oh, I'm a different person in these different places. And so that at least like really resonates me from that like kind of small piece of, you know, like obviously I'm a white person and fully American, but like still that kind of like cultural, like having multiple cultural identities is a like really complicated thing.
Yeah, it is. And I think like your experience of growing up in a rural Alaskan area is a very different experience from my experience growing up in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And a very different experience from growing up in New York. So mm-hmm. you do carry that with you. It is part of you and it is very different. And it is something that maybe the average person you're going to meet now won't necessarily understand about you.
Right. And it's easy to like hide in some ways, you know, it does sometimes feel like, oh yeah, I'm from this alternate reality, but like, you know, you all don't know that. Especially, you know, first time I meet someone, it's always fun to throw out the like, oh yeah, I grew up in Alaska as a fundamentalist Christian, like, you know, without running water card. Like that always throws people for a loop.
I mean, yeah, it's a lot.
It is. Jeez. Anyway, not to make this all about me as I am wont to do. Cool. Were there other questions, Matt, that you had about this topic?
Oh man, I was so many. I don't know how much we want to go down this.
Right,
this
and path. Like totally put you on the spot, Julia.
Yeah.
I mean, that's okay. It's what I'm here for.
One thing that I was interested in that is related to the Tea Master and the Detective in particular is secondary world building from like a cross-cultural mm-hmm. perspective, which I think is mm-hmm. a super cool topic for all kinds of reasons, all kinds of ways we could try to approach that. In this book, you know, clearly there's Vietnamese and also Chinese influences, but there's other stuff too. I mean, you know, it's like, as is the nature, I think, of secondary world stuff, it's a melting pot because people's heads are melting pots. What do you think about this stuff, Julia?
I mean, yeah, I think that that's true. I think that it's interesting to examine that sort of thing. And you can take some sort of examples like Firefly, the Joss Whedon show, which is ostensibly a secondary world show where they've all gone off into space and there's big Chinese influence, but the cast is mostly white and they randomly just curse in Chinese. And that's the sort of thing that, like, I think at the time, a lot of people were like, whoa, that's really interesting. And I don't really feel like that has aged particularly well. And I feel like even at the time, there were probably people who were like, this is pretty racist. I think it's really easy to think about something and be like, oh, that's cool, and just sort of throw it in without really examining the full ramifications of what having that aspect of a culture in a secondary world would mean. And I think that anytime someone is building a cross-cultural world, the important things to think about are like, how does that affect every aspect of it? Because it will affect every aspect of it. Like, we have lots of different cultural groups in the United States, and all of those different cultures affect how those people are living in the United States and how the people in their communities are. So with Mexican Americans, a lot of them are involved in agriculture. So we get a lot of our food from Mexican Americans who are working for very low wages, or Mexicans, or people who are undocumented. And then there's a question of like how the dominant culture treats the undocumented workers. And does your secondary culture require documentation? And there are lots of questions to answer about that, and lots of questions to sort of dig into about how the political and just community attitudes towards people affect their daily lives. I think a really great example of a different cultural cross is the sequel to Sorcerer to the Crown by Zen Cho, The True Queen. Actually, Sorcerer to the Crown is also great, but The True Queen really goes deeper into the sort of Malaysian culture. And these are set in like an alternate Regency England with magic. So kind of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell-esque type of scenario, except that the main character has this Malaysian descent and connections to Malaysian magic, and the questions of like how those things are different between her heritage and the British heritage, and how the British treat her and various things like that are all, I think, really interesting to dig into.
That's really fascinating. I had never heard of this series before, but I am very into that.
Zen Cho is dope.
Yeah, Zen Cho is super great, and I recommend all of her work. She's wonderful.
Yeah, cool. I think it's, at least in our original science fiction focus, I mean, Zen Cho is more, I think, of a sort of surface-level fantasy-seeming type of thing.
Right.
Yeah. That's why I didn't suggest it, because you guys were like, well, hopefully it's science fiction. And I was like, all right, so not Zen Cho.
Oh, yeah. We should have been more explicit. Like, we're pretty okay with, you know, fantasy being a part of science fiction, like larger speculative kind of works.
I mean, talking about these, like, you know, genre issues is fun too.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, that is maybe one thing to like pull into, you know, this is a space opera kind of on the face of it. Although one that in reading it so far feels very like different than a lot of space opera. Like on the one hand, you have the sort of like Banksian, like ship mind AI type thing going on. But then on the other hand, you have this sort of like very, you know, like humans need to like drink herbal tinctures, like herbal teas in order to like cross the stars, right? There's this sort of like, you know, sort of like tie to like the natural world. And almost this sort of like sense of magic of like, you know, I have to brew a potion for you to be able to like, you know, enter deep space going on, which I really like this kind of like, you know, it makes it feel like a very tactile world, whereas a lot of space opera can feel very like abstract in some ways.
Yeah. So I had heard a lot of people sort of comparing this favorably to The Ship Who Sang by Anne McCaffrey, which was a book that I read as a child and loved and have been afraid to revisit as an adult, because even without having reread it, I feel like there are some problems with it. But I loved it so much when I was very small. And so I'm really interested to read this, because some of the things that I've heard people say about this are that you have a ship with sentience, but the ship kind of has their own agenda, its own agenda. I'm not sure of the ship's gender or if gender matters to the ship.
It's a her, actually, explicitly.
Okay.
For reasons okay. that become
so
apparent.
The ship has her own agenda and has her own agency. And I feel like that is very cool. And I'm really interested to see how that works.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's another aspect of the tinctures that of course is something that I love, which is its connection to a lot of, I guess you'd call it
like Chinese derived tea ceremony.
Yeah. So there's a whole conversation to be had about like Chinese fantasy genre distinctions, which are very different from sort of traditional English language genre distinctions. So I know some people use the word cultivator to talk about fiction. I think that that's a sort of a weird choice of words in some ways, but basically there's a lot of stories that involve Taoist magic or pursuit of immortality or physical attainment that involve improving your body or like taking weird potions or like doing certain specific types of training in order to like take your body to the next level or your mind to the next level. And that goes all the way back to actual ancient manuals of Taoist magic. But like in fiction land, you know, Journey to the West has a lot of this. Monkey in Journey to the West steals some like potions from Lao Tzu in heaven in order to like, you know, just like drink them.
And this
happens a lot in all kinds of different fiction. there's a lot of sometimes this genre in Chinese is like called xianxia. The xian is a word that means Taoist immortal, and xia is a word that means like knight errant or like warrior errant or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that's an aspect of this. I don't know if it was intentional at all, but it just like reminds me of that stuff and that kind mm-hmm. of vibe of story.
Totally, totally. Well, I think there's clearly this sort of like, you know, larger sense of like a tea ceremony and this idea of like, you know, sharing tea with someone being very important that, you know, my understanding kind of like originates in Chinese tea culture and then like spreads out from there to like, you know, there's different tea ceremonies in Japan versus Vietnam versus Thailand versus all these different places. You know, I think too, there's a sort of like semi-explicit, like sort of like Buddhist element to the some of the world building as well, which will be maybe we should like dig into that in the post read actually, now that I think about it. I think that'll be more fruitful to actually talk about it in specific there. But it is cool. It's just this really neat sense of like, you know, one of the things I like about it, having read, you know, 40, 50 pages, something like that, not quite half the book yet, is it feels like a very like real lived in culture, right? Like it doesn't feel like this kind of thing that you get with Joss Whedon where it's like, oh yeah, slap some Chinese curse words on it and like, ooh, look at that. It rather feels like, you know, there's this culture that's developed over, you know, thousands of years on Earth and then thousands of years again in space. And it is both like derived from that culture, and you see those cultural elements as they kind of like come forward, but also those cultural elements have changed and like been molded by the situation that they're in now. It's not simply taking the Earth culture and transplanting it somewhere else. It's this feeling of like, you know, movement and like long development to it, like tradition that has been like both developed over a very, very long time and also like itself changed by very recent events, right? That these traditions in any culture are always in flux and are not just like abstract traditions, but actually like practices that individual people practice, and each practice in their own way.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that aspect of it too. I don't know if we want to move on to this already, but there is one whole other aspect, sort of genre aspect of the novel that's really fun, that's probably potentially obvious from the title, the word detective. So this does also, you know, involve kind of lots of references to classic detective stories, which is a really cool thing to bring into a science fiction setting. Do you guys have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I would say beyond detective, I mean, you know, tell me if I'm wrong, but it feels like specifically like Sherlockian, right? Like there seems to be like a specific like Sherlock Holmes vibe to it so far.
What does that mean to you, Adrian?
Well, it's a
this is not a trick question. I'm literally
right.
I know
right.
That my
no,
tone
you, you actually
like
means like, what does that mean? I would say that, you know, like kind of a, like a, like this kind of focus on, right, like a somewhat mysterious, solitary, and like logical character, right? While the story itself is written by a much more like empathetic and like interested person who is also like very fascinated with this detective character. So it's both a method of the like the narrator of the story as well as the lead detective character in the story has this kind of vibe where she is this like, you know, solitary, somewhat of an academic, unclear where she comes from, and also like, you know, has this way of looking at the world that is like maybe, you know, sort of like 50 degrees orthogonal to the way everyone else does, but lets her see things that no one else can because of that. And it feels very like, you know, in this mold of a, you know, Sherlock Holmes story in that way.
Yeah. Without getting too much into the actual book itself, I'm really interested in the ideas and like what makes a story Holmesian or what makes a classic detective story, and what might the difference between those two things be, and what might the sort of larger heritage of detective stories be in our modern kind of fiction universe. I think it's really, really interesting. Obviously, anybody who's listened to this before will probably know that I love talking about this sort of
right.
Submerged...
So what do you think a Holmesian story is in that case?
I love talking about the sort of submerged history of these things. I mean, Holmesian stories in particular, One of the really interesting things about Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes stories is the way that they have had a profound effect not only on fiction, but also on people's sort of broader cultural conception of how crime works and like what it is to be a detective and what it is to solve a mystery or solve a crime. A lot of our ideas about these sort of things come from his stories. And his stories come from, because prior to the mid 19th century, prior specifically to the memoir of Eugène Vidocq, the French criminal turned police investigator who operated in the July monarchy and kind of wrote this amazing memoir about his life of crime and his turn to detective work. Vidocq kind of invented the idea of being a detective, and a lot of detective fiction springs from that wellspring, because prior to that, there was no real concept. I mean, not in the West anyway, there were other types of concepts. There were certainly concepts of judges and of justice and of catching criminals, but there wasn't a concept as we know of it today, the CSI style, like, oh, a crime has been committed, let us investigate.
Like investigating.
Yeah. Right. Let us put together clues. There's a thing called a clue. Here, this is what a clue is. There's a thing called a criminal. A criminal is not just somebody who has committed some particular sin in like isolation or even who is leading a sinful life. A criminal is almost like a job description of a person who like, you know, and this is what that job is characterized by. And this is a lifestyle associated with that, you know?
Right. And there's different kind, like you can be a burglar or you can be like a hacker now, right? Like that's like a new job that's been created.
Right. So the world building that Conan Doyle did, based in part on Vidocq, based also on Poe, who got his stuff from Hugo and Vidocq, and like people like Théophile Gautier, who also got stuff from Vidocq, like, you know, Conan Doyle's world building that he did, you know, is responsible in part for creating our total conception of what these social roles mean in the world today. Mm-hmm. A lot of cops, you know, back then, people who, you know, because police work was in its infancy in the mid 19th century, a lot of people who were getting into those careers and building the structures that still persist today that define what those careers are, you know, were reading these stories and were influenced by them, and were influenced by, or perhaps were influenced by the boys' own stories or the like dime novels that were themselves based on these stories.
Right.
So I think there's a lot to be said about how detective fiction, as described by Conan Doyle, has really done a lot to create our conceptions of what these words even mean. Mm-hmm. And then the more specific, like, what is Holmesian? I mean, to me, I think of kind of the same thing you were thinking of, Adrian, like the specific characters and their specific relationship, you know? The specific character of Sherlock Holmes is not just any detective, right?
Yeah, well, and for me, I think it goes a little bit beyond that even, because the specific character of Sherlock Holmes is a very specific logical character, but you have that same kind of detective archetype, the loner detective, in things like Poirot by Agatha Christie.
Yep.
What's different about Holmes, and I think things that emulate Holmes or descend from Holmes, is the Holmes-Watson dynamic. He is a soul genius, and he has all sorts of character flaws. And Watson is there to sort of bounce everything off and also to help make up for some of those character flaws. Like, Watson's way better at dealing with social interactions. So I feel like I haven't read this one yet, but the reason why I would assume people are constantly comparing it to Sherlock Holmes is because you have that detective, but you also have the ship playing that sort of supportive Watson role.
Right. The ship is even specifically a veteran, which I think is interesting.
Oh,
because
wow.
that's a specific like element of like Watts's character archetype that I feel gets missed in a lot of like modern readaptations, but he is like a war veteran and in fact a medic, and like a lot of his psychology and sort of like the way he reacts to things are like really influenced by that background that he has. You know, the stories in which he becomes kind of a character in them are usually like unwitting, because he's like reacting in some sort of way based on his own, you know, previous experiences. I'm curious, have you guys, you know, actually, Julia, I'm actually really curious. Have any of the modern-ish Sherlock Holmes adaptations come up on your podcast yet, like young Sherlock Holmes or anything like that?
Not yet, but I assume it's just a matter of time.
Oh man, that would be so good.
Well, and I am curious, like, what your kind of background with Sherlock, so, like, was that something you read as a kid or read as an adult or anything like that?
Yeah, so I read Sherlock Holmes stories as a kid, definitely. I had like a Conan Doyle volume that was
excellent,
probably fairly old. I think it was actually like a hardbound red book with gold like writing on the spine. That had been well beat up. Like, it was definitely not, it did not start with me. It had been passed down through generations. And so I remember reading that when I was a kid. As an adult, I've seen a lot of media adaptations, and I've also read some other things. One of my favorite series currently is Sherry Thomas has a Lady Sherlock series, and in her alternate version, Charlotte Holmes is pretending to be her brother Sherlock, who doesn't exist, because she knows that people will take a man more seriously in 1800s London. And she has Mrs. Watson, who is an old actress and has taken her in and works with her. And she also has a sister, and she has various other family members and friends that make appearances. But it's a really interesting sort of take on the Sherlock idea, and I've really enjoyed it. It's like very fun reading. It's very light in the sort of like, I hesitate to say light because bad things happen to people. And there is definitely the constant tension and fear. But at the same time, like, it is a very warm-hearted ensemble cast that you actually like, and you want them to succeed, and you like watching them work together as a reader. And I think that that's also really interesting because Charlotte herself is like, obviously there are no diagnoses, but like, maybe she would, if she were living in modern day, be diagnosed as on the autism spectrum.
Right.
And she's very beautiful, but so people assume that she should have been going into polite society and have a good marriage, but she does not want that. So she very deliberately ruins her chances of doing that by arranging to get caught in a compromising position with a man that is married. And then she is sort of like lives on the fringes of society with an old actress and goes out of her parents' house. But there's also a worry because her sisters are, she has two sisters. One of them has a severe anxiety, and the other one is not like mentally really present. So it's unclear. It's unclear what any of them would be diagnosed as, but like the younger, or possibly, I think actually she's the oldest sister, but they treat her like the youngest because she needs constant care. And so the constant worry is that her parents are going to send her off to be in some sort of asylum where she doesn't have her family. And I think that that provides a really interesting interpersonal dynamic already. And then you add in different things. Sherry Thomas is also, I'm not sure what her background is, but I know she's Asian American. So she has brought in different cultural aspects as well to that telling. And I don't know. I think it's a lot of fun, and it's really interesting, and it's kind of modernized up in a way that also treats women a lot better than I think Conan Doyle did.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, also you brought something up that I just wanted to circle back on the content warnings, like, really, really quickly, which is that like, this novella also deals with like trauma specifically, and sort of this like, you know, it kind of like, I would, you know, say like shell shock or PTSD or whatever might be a kind of like more modern interpretation of it, but the main character has this like real trauma and fear around some stuff that happened to her like while she was a veteran. And you know, that might be something people should be aware of. Like, we talk about this being a really cozy novel, like, at the same time, it's like a mystery story where like bad things have happened to people and like, you know, there's bad things all over the place. It is this kind of interesting like push and pull of these kinds of stories, where often these sort of like cozy murder mysteries, well, it's like at the heart of it is death, at the heart of it is this murder. yet there is something that feels so like warm about them. Like I think of like Knives Out would be like to me a very interesting comp to this novella so far, where it's like, you know, and that's more of a like Hercule Poirot version of a detective. But it is this feeling of like, okay, well, like a man is dead and there's all these terrible people around and like we have to find out who did it. But also like it feels really nice to watch.
It does feel really nice to watch. Although I will say like there are definitely content warnings that apply if you're going to watch Knives Out.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I think about this a lot with cozy mysteries because I love cozy murder mysteries. And sometimes I will announce to my house, it's time for murder, which means it's time to watch a cozy murder on TV.
Yeah.
Or to read one. And
well, I mean, Murder, She Wrote, as we were talking about
exactly
earlier.
But I mean, that's just the latest one. I love a lot of these. And it's really funny to me to think about the way that such horrible stuff can be so cozy. And of course, I think really it comes back to the formula. The formula makes it cozy. Mm-hmm. And the like reliably protagonist-y protagonist, you know, as part of the formula. Those are very, very important things.
Right.
Coziness.
Mysteries are really reassuring in the same way that romances are, in that you know that whatever happens in the end, you're going to find out who did it and the person who's investigating is going to solve it. Yeah. And so like even when people aren't necessarily happy, it's still kind of like there's this reassuring stability there.
Yep. Well, I think of Knives Out too. There's this feeling of like, okay, your whole family is horrible, but in, you know, the form of Daniel Craig, like you do have like a dad who is going to be like, make things good in the end. You know, it's like, there's this like, you know, to psychoanalyze it a little bit, but like there is a dad and like, he will like make things right by you in the end.
Oh man, there is a dad.
Okay. I like going very Freudian with this, but you know, it's me. So what are you going to do?
I love it. Yeah. Big fan of cozy formula.
Right. Whereas cozy. Sherlock Holmes is not a dad figure, right? Like he's a lot of things, but he is not like a dad in the same way as some other cozy murder mysteries.
No, he is definitely not.
Right.
But there is a found family aspect to it, I think. There's a constant sort of tension.
Holmes and Watson, totally.
One of the interesting things about the Holmes-Watson relationship is the sort of constant tension between like, is this found family secure or not? Like, is Holmes going to run off or not? Like, is Holmes actually committed to this or not? You know?
Right. Is Holmes going to go on some drug bender and disappear for a year?
Is Holmes going to just like OD randomly? Yeah.
For real. For real.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also an aspect that often gets overlooked in the modern reinterpretations, which is a little bit too bad, is that Holmes is constantly like drugged to the gills.
Yeah. It's a thing.
Yeah. It makes him, but it makes him like a you know, it makes him in the original stories, I find, like a really kind of compelling character because, in some ways, like he's so smart and so sharp, but also really tragic. And that sort of like tension creates a really interesting character opportunity where so often all you take is the kind of smart bit in the modern reinterpretations. And so you kind of lose out on him as a character and he becomes simply like a, you know, crime solving automata, which is like not all that interesting for me to watch personally.
Yeah. I mean, I think the drug aspect is really quite interesting because it reminds, like there's a lot of like, it's a whole other thread of heritage for these sorts of stories. Mm-hmm. The Victorian like literary drug culture, you
right.
know, where like a lot of really like a lot of the famous authors of the period, like did opium, you
right.
know, and like
or cocaine,
a lot of,
you know, or right, like whatever right. they had access to.
Yeah. And a lot of famous stories involve it. And then there's like De Quincey, you know, I mean, Confessions of an English Opium Eater as a like source for Holmesian stories or a source for some of, especially when you get to the connections between detective fiction and horror, of which there are many, you know, Poe is the Poe and Gautier are early versions of that. But there's a sort of obvious connection because of death. I mean, death brings that in very quickly. And then you get the cosmic horror coming in through the drugs via confessions of an English opium eater. And then mm-hmm. very quickly you get to the sort of cosmic horror mystery, which is this whole other thing. I think that all these connections are super interesting to me. This book isn't cosmic horror, but it's just interesting.
I mean, but it's also not cosmic horror.
There's a kind
set
of
set in the cosmos, and there are like this deep space thing in the world building we'll get to, like has these sort of like, you know, unknowable aspects to it. And like that sense of the unknowable is always like a really kind of like fun, interesting addition to the like, you know, like what happens when you have Sherlock Holmes who is able to like figure anything out and you give him a problem that like is unknowable, right? Like that's kind of an interesting like juxtaposition. And I think part of why like cosmic horror and detective stories often like line up together so well.
Yeah. And the drugs, I mean, like the tinctures mm-hmm. that you need to survive in deep space is very horror aspect, very like Victorian drug taking it, you know, in a way.
Cool.
Okay, very interesting.
Are there any other pieces that we should hit on this before we let folks go read? You know, we're probably talking for longer than it's going to take you to read the novella. So hopefully you pick it up and read it. It's like, you know, $3 on Amazon, go for it. Or, you know, a better, less terrible company, but you know, do what you can in these times of ebook only.
Kubo
and the Two Strings. Sorry, I'm now just free associating. Julia, is there anything else that you would like to mention, sort of like context for this book? Maybe actually the thing we should do, and I'd love to hear from you, are like, you know, comps. Like I mentioned Knives Out, but like, do you have any other, like, you know, folks who like this book might like X, or folks who like X might like this book?
I haven't yet read this book, so I don't know for sure that I can give comps. I will say that if you do like a good Sherlock Holmes story, go check out the Lady Sherlock series by Sherry Thomas. I think the first one is A Study in Scarlet. But if you just look up Sherry Thomas, Lady Sherlock, you'll find them. And those are really fun. I also would say if you love a good women solving mysteries and women who are monsters story, go check out the Strange Case of the Alchemist's Daughter by Theodora Goss, because that's cool. A really fun. If you want to talk about found family ensemble casts and mystery solving and monstrous cosmic horrors, that's a great one for you. It's a trilogy. All three books are out. You can get all of them. They're very comforting.
Excellent.
So into that.
Excellent. I love comforting cosmic horror like that. There needs to be a word for that.
Oh, yeah. So the premise of those books is that basically like a bunch of the dudes that you know of from classic stories, like Victor Frankenstein and Dr. Mm-hmm. Jekyll and all of those people, have basically been experimenting on their own daughters.
Oh, whoa.
And
that's intense.
Their daughters are the main characters.
Holy shit. That is intense. But it's cozy, you say.
It is. It starts out with Mary Jekyll dealing with like her mother's death, and now she's going to have to figure out how to like get by, finding out that her family has very little money. Her father's been dead for a while. And then like suddenly unraveling more and more of a mystery that she didn't ask for. And she's the very logical person. She's a very logical and very calm person. And then like her life gets completely upended as she finds out all sorts of things that she took for granted are just not actually true. And then she finds all sorts of other people and things get weirder and weirder.
I have heard good things about these. It might be a good one for me to check out next.
I will check those out as well. That sounds really phenomenal. I will say that the one other comp I will mention so far, in addition, like kind of separately from the detective story stuff, you know, Knives Out, watch it. It's great. Is also like Ian M. Banks's culture novels, like the space opera-esque world building definitely has elements of that in it. And I think in particular, if you like the like ships with minds and personalities that are like both kind of like human-ish, but also like different because they are an actual ship, but they're also kind of quirky and have their own stuff going on. Like there's an element of this to that that I just love. It's actually a thing that I find really comforting. I love these kind of stories about ships with personalities, and like, yeah. I'm loving this because of that.
It's one we've talked about a lot on this show, but I think cozy space adventure, Binti.
Yep.
Yep. That's a super fun genre. I'm really into it.
Yep.
Read all the Binti things.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And if you've enjoyed Binti, especially, you know, in that it's a similar kind of like novella length, like single serving story type thing, this is a good comp to pick up and enjoy. And there's two more sort of set in the same universe. I'm probably honestly going to pick them up when I finish reading this one and read those as well. So might at least mention what they're about in the post read.
I also thought a little of Tobias Bekele's stuff.
Oh, that's a really good. Yeah,
mainly for the world building.
Right, but I mean, he has the Caribbean really aspects fun. In his world building, and there is that sense of like cultural kind of exchange through it.
Yeah,
yeah, that's
a
great call.
And of course, regular listeners will know that we have talked to him on the pod.
Indeed, very good guy. I really enjoyed that conversation. Cool.
All right, guys. Sounds good.
I think that's good for us. Thank you so much for suggesting this book, Julia, and for coming on. We've like wanted you as a guest for a while, so this is very exciting. We're really excited about it.
We bagged a whale.
Okay. Oh, I'm not sure about that, but I hopefully that is taken.
I really appreciate your
it's my
profound...
finance bro version of this.
Your profound excitement overwhelms me. No, it was super fun. I was very glad to be able to come and do this. I'm really looking forward to reading the book and talking with you about it. I know that we're going to have a great conversation because I know both of you have lots of insightful things to say about everything you read, so
thank you.
Be fun.
I appreciate that. That's very kind of you. I feel the same way about you, so I think this will be a lot of fun. And go listen
excited.
To Julia's podcast. This is why we're like this.
You will like
the
it.
Mexican
it's so
X
good.
Stuff. Yep, it's really good. It's really, especially I think if you like what we do of over analyzing what things mean, then it's perfect for you.
It's just
talk
so
about
homey.
If you like us, you'll like
that.
It is.
I will say, like, my podcast also involves a lot of like, you know, sometimes swearing and dirty jokes. So just FYI, beware that that's, you're not just getting straight up cultural analysis. You're also getting, also going to get like the, that's what she said part. So
I will say, you know, I brought this up to Matt too, when I was listening to your episode about Angela Lansbury, I did just want to be like, let old people fuck. Like, it's okay. She wants to fuck. Let her fuck.
No, I mean, like, honestly, like, mad respect. I just also was like, I am so used to Murder, She Wrote, and I'm not, I was just not prepared.
I think the tough
really
thing about those
listening
videos
to you guys.
Is the tough thing about those videos is how is how the camera lingers and where the camera lingers.
It just really lingers.
It's...
and. I don't know. It's something.
So if you want to know what we mean by this, you got to go listen to that episode because I'm not going to provide context.
Yeah, that's going to be the After These Messages episode that Matt is on, where we talk about Mr. Limpet and Angela Lansbury.
It's excellent. It's very, very fun.
Is there another episode that you'd point folks too, if they want to start out somewhere?
I mean, Matt's episode, the Bedknobs and Broomsticks episode, is really good. We also, the most recent episode at the time of our recording this was The Adventures of Mark Twain. And every time we do this, like Spectology, we do two different ones. We do a main episode and a bonus episode. And our main episode is the movie itself. And then our bonus is advertising or other short things related to that. So The Adventures of Mark Twain is a 1980s claymation movie. Mm-hmm. It's actually the movie that spawned the term claymation. The guy who made it is the creator of claymation. And
it's wild.
It is wild. It's basically like about Mark Twain on the verge of death, building an airship and kidnapping Tom Sawyer, Becky Thatcher, and Huck Finn, and taking them on a quest to find Halley's Comet so that he can see it and then die. And then you see a bunch of other little dips into different parts of his work and also the devil. It's good times.
Right.
Whoa.
It's very like psychedelic children's TV show style.
Oh, man.
That episode is really it was wild. And then on top of that, we then did advertising related to it was all stuff done by Will Vinton, the creator. So the California Raisins and the Noid from Domino's and the Orange Crispy M&M. But the California Raisins, that's our latest episode, is the California Raisins episode. And it's like full of drama. I had no idea that there was so much raisin advertising drama. So if you would like to hear about the rise and fall of the California Raisins, and there is both, then go to This Is Why We're Like This.
I am super into all of this. Definitely what I'm doing this evening.
So good.
Oh, cool. Well, I hope folks go take a listen. That sounds like a lot of fun. I'm going to go listen. So, okay. Well, guys, thank you so much for coming on, for doing this. You know, I hope everyone is as healthy as can be right now. Our listeners and you too. And, yeah, we'll be back with more bonus episodes this month and also our post read at some point. Who knows what scheduling is? We also have some new extra episodes coming out, which I think will get announced later on in this week. I'll have an announcement about that also on the same feed as this, but it's happening. I just don't have details finalized, so I don't want to talk about it too much, but it's really exciting. We'll have extra episodes while we're all in quarantine, at least, helping out science fiction authors and other like new authors in particular. So that'll be really cool. So thank you again. SpectrologyPod on Twitter, SpectrologyPod@gmail.com. Julia, are there places online people should follow you, like Twitter or anything like that?
Sure. I'm at OMGJulia on Twitter. So that anytime anyone tweets at me, it's like they're saying, OMG, Julia, I have to tell you this thing.
I love that.
I literally read it like that every time I get added. So just FYI.
Oh, I love that so much. So go follow Julia there. Follow us. Stay safe and healthy. Wash your hands. Wear a mask. Stay inside. And
drink your milk.
Drink your milk or nut milks or whatever, you know, beverage of your choice. Drink your warm tea and like make it with love and care. We will talk to you later. Bye, everyone. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.